Hello and welcome, Brian Borgman.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, very good, Brian. Thank you so much for
Good.
taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Brian, tell us everything we need to know about you in 60 seconds.
I'm married to Wonder Woman. Her name is Ariel. She's absolutely fantastic. We'll be married 37 years this year. And I've got three grown children, and I've got six grandkids. And I just clocked my 30th year as the founding pastor of Grace Community Church this last weekend. I think that's 60 seconds.
Brilliant, wonderful, wonderful, Brian. Well, let's go back to the beginning. How did you become a Christian?
Yeah, so I was raised Roman Catholic, and my dad was raised in a small German Swedish farming community in Northern California. And so he was raised Catholic. My mom wasn't raised anything, but she had to become Catholic to marry my dad in 1966. And so my mom and dad were Catholics. My mom got remarkably converted around 1978, I think. Really just stunning. My dad ended up having a crisis of faith. He's listening to J. Vernon McGee while he was a truck driver for United Parcel Service. He was listening to McGee. He didn't feel it was right to read his Bible because, of course, he was that generation. And so a priest actually told him, "Hey, it's okay, read the Bible." He started reading the word. He got converted. And then I was the holdout. I was an altar boy. Even though I was wicked, as a 12-year-old boy, I took a tremendous amount of pride in being Catholic. And so my mom and dad told me, "Hey, we'll take you to Mass every other week. You come to church with us every other week." And I said, "Okay." Well, I mean, that seemed fair, right? And so, but God really started to work in my heart at about 12, 13 years old, just a deep conviction of sin. My mom gave me a Bible and I started reading it because, it's just sort of a Catholic mindset, maybe do more religious stuff and you won't have to feel so guilty. And I finally came to the realization by God's grace, reading the Sermon on the Mount, that I would never be good enough unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees. You will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. And I just began to see that God actually loved me. He wasn't angry with me, ready to squash me. And that Jesus, not the church, was my savior. And I was 13 years old.
Yeah, wow, amazing. So when did you feel a call to ministry?
Well, it was sort of interesting. We didn't know anything, right? I mean, we're raised Catholic. We had very little understanding. And I entered into high school, and at age 14, I started to have this really this overwhelming sense of wanting to serve the Lord. I didn't know what it looked like. I didn't know. I mean, I had no clue. I just felt like my whole life needed to be dedicated to serving the Lord. And so around 14, I started to have that in a sense, that compulsion to want to do something. And I didn't know that. Does that mean be a pastor? Does it mean be a missionary? Does it mean, be the next Billy Graham or something? I didn't know. But in God's kindness, at age 15, our own church wasn't. I'll just put it this way, brother. The church that I went to, they didn't know what to do with a 14, 15-year-old young man who was earnest and zealous for the Lord. And thanks be to God, a neighbor of ours put me in touch with her nephew, who was a Southern Baptist pastor in Texas. And he befriended me and helped me a tremendous amount during my teenage years in terms of understanding, at least more clearly, the call, what that might look like. And so when I became college age. I went to Biola University in order to become a Bible major. I just wanted to learn the word. I knew that whatever I was going to do, which I didn't know what it was at that time, I would need a thorough grounding in the scriptures and theology. And then I went up to seminary in Portland. And that's where I think that my sense of calling began to be more focused. And it was there that the idea of planting a church and then pastoring that church became very clear to me.
Yeah, wow. Brilliant. Well as all of the other things that you do, Brian, you're also an author. And you've just written a new book on Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes is such a helpful book within the canon of scripture, isn't it? What made you want to write a commentary on it, and why now?
Well, that's a story, because I, like just millions of other believers, I was intrigued by Ecclesiastes, because there's so much stuff in Ecclesiastes that just sounds so weird. So I hated life, or money's the answer to everything, right? And you're like, how did this get in the Bible? And and so in college, I took every class I could that would touch on Ecclesiastes, whether it was wisdom literature elective or, you know, whatever. I did the same in seminary. I just was intrigued with the book. And so as time went on, I started to realize that it was, I guess I could say it like this. I felt that there was something in the book that I was missing, but that if I could find it, it would be profoundly helpful. And so it really started me on a quest of just digging into the book. I would collect, I still to this day, collect journal articles, every new commentary that comes out, and just scouring through. And so the book, I preached the book at our church in 2004, maybe right around there. But I never stopped. I've, in a sense, I've written three books on Ecclesiastes over the years. And it was this last one that where I felt that just sort of the process of maturing, having become a grandfather, having, you know, my mother die, having had a massive brain tumor in 2016, all of these life events really sort of compelled me to get back to this book that had always just intrigued me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all good hermeneutics means that we need to start at the beginning and look at the genre and the author. So who was the author of Ecclesiastes, and what do we know about the life that he lived?
So I would argue, and it is the minority report, I think, I would argue that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. Now, that doesn't seem highly unusual to the ordinary Bible reader, but it is sort of unusual in scholarly circles to affirm Solomonic authorship. But I think that Solomon is the writer. I also think that with Walt Kaiser, that this reflects, expresses Solomon in old age, and hopefully is reflective of a repentant perspective on the life that he had lived.
Yeah. Yeah. You've written in your book, and I've heard you say this before, that Ecclesiastes is often misunderstood, and you've read all that there is on the internet and in print about this book. Why do you think that it is misunderstood, and what are those misunderstandings?
Yeah, in one sense, it actually ends up being really, really simple, because you have this thematic statement right out of the gate in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, 1:2, and I'll just give the traditional rendering: vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. And that is, in a sense, that's one of the most comprehensive thematic statements anybody could say at the beginning of a book. It also is the bookend, right? So You have it at the beginning of the book. You have it at the end of the book. And I think that one of the reasons why Ecclesiastes has been misunderstood for such a long time is because you take the Hebrew word that we translate vanity. It's the word hevel. And the word hevel is breath, vapor, or mist, right? So when Jerome is translating the Vulgate, he translates the Hebrew word hevel as vanitas. Okay. And as we know, it's very easy to sort of get translational traditions that's very hard to break out of. And so, the King James goes vanity of vanities. And then a lot of English translations will do something that's similar, meaninglessness or futility. And so what happens is, this is the non-mysterious part, really. You have the word vanity, and if everything is vanity, right, or everything is meaningless, then that, in a sense, shapes the way that you view the whole book, right? If you have this comprehensive thematic statement right at the beginning, and you have the statement that everything is vanity, or everything is futility, or everything is meaningless, then everything in the book then is supposed to reflect that. And so I think that gives us, in a sense, an overall negative reading of Ecclesiastes, all right? And by negative, I mean we look at it, and so now we've got a problem. Now we've got a book that we're saying is telling us that everything is meaningless and or vanity. And so then what ends up happening is now we got to figure out, well, what is this book doing in the canon of scripture, right? So the old Scholefield Reference Bible, for instance, actually says, so the wisdom here is just man's wisdom. This is just under the sun wisdom. And yeah. Of course, if that's the case, then, why not throw Aristotle or Confucius in and just say, okay, it's accurately recorded, but here it is. And so it doesn't answer the question. So then a lot of people, and I'll just summarize it, most of the negative views end up being some sort of Solomon's trying to depress you into believing in God, or there's some sort of dialectical conversation going on within Solomon himself as, on the one hand, the cynic and the believer, or something like that, some sort of framework where you have these little pigeonhole categories where if Solomon says something that sounds holy, okay, well, that's the man of faith. But if he says something that sounds just outrageously cynical, you put him in that category, and he's debating with himself. And all of that is the necessary fruit of seeing the book as negative. But yeah. if you take the word hevel and keep its basic meaning, so Abel, Avel, right? That's the name that's given to him in Genesis 4. Why? Because his life was a breath,
yeah.
Right? You see this word, it's used most in Ecclesiastes 38 times, but it is breath, wind, vapor, mist. And so if everything is vapor, okay, then what Solomon is agonizing over in the book is not the meaninglessness of life, but the brevity of life.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, David, that actually resonates with everyone.
That's right.
Where if you go breath of breaths, everything is a breath. And you go, okay, but then Solomon follows that up with another thematic question. So what's the advantage that a person has after basically the agony of life is really short, it's a breath, it's a vapor, James 4:14, right? Your life is a mere breath. And so if that's the case, and I spend the majority of my life, especially the prime of my life, laboring, working day in, day out in what seems like monotony, what's left over? What's the advantage? And so I think Solomon takes us on a journey of in a sense, sort of navigating through life, knowing that it's short. And here's the ultimate exclamation point, Havel, and that is, we all die, right?
Yeah.
Death is an absolute certainty.
So helpful. We're going to be talking about that word in a few moments as well. And I'm sure, Brian, everyone listening, as we get older, we'll all have a sense that life goes by faster and faster. Everyone says it all the time, don't they? Every year goes by. How's it March already? Why is Ecclesiastes a helpful book in helping us navigate these feelings?
Yeah, so I think that this is one of the beautiful things about Ecclesiastes, because we all have that experience, right? You look at your kids and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, I mean, all of my kids are grown. And it seems just like day before yesterday that they were running around the house and playing and going to school and all of that. And you start to feel, if we could use a mixed metaphor, you start to feel the weight of how vaporous life is, how short it is. And I think that what Solomon does for us is Solomon actually points us to a number of things in totally different ways throughout the book. But I would say the first thing that he points us to is this. Look, life is a gift from God. Even though it's short, even though it is just a mere breath, it's still a gift. That breath is God's gift to you. And so you need to embrace that gift as a gift. Now, if you want to ruin it, turn it into achievement, right? Turn it into self-monument. Turn it into self-gratification. If you want to ruin the breath, if you want to erase the gift quality of life, then look at it as achievement. So I think the application of that ends up being profound, right? So just take raising kids, for instance. Okay.
Yes.
If I look at the raising of my kids and then them leaving the nest, and if I become so depressed that, oh, I miss it when they were little, oh, I miss those days of Little League, oh, I miss those days of having them sit around the dinner table and listening to their funny little conversations, oh, I'm just pining for those days, then what we're doing is we're actually casting a very dark shadow over the next chapter of a mere breath, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm looking back with regret and I can't believe how fast it's gone, not only do I fail to look at that past chapter as a gift, I'm failing to look at the present chapter as a gift. So Ecclesiastes helps me come to grips with the fact that my life is a breath. It's a series of very short breaths. Each one is a gift. Accept it, embrace it, rejoice in it as a gift, and don't spoil the turning page by longing for what's now past. I think that's profoundly helpful to us.
Yeah, brilliant. So helpful. Well, we're only 18 minutes and I think you've already sold your book, Brian. I think everyone's going to be rushing off to go and order it right now. And within your book, you obviously speak about the importance of this word, Hevel, and you do a really good job of tracing back the history of the word's usage as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I've touched on it a little bit, but that original Hebrew word, Hevel, is what is in the book of Ecclesiastes, obviously. And when the Hebrew scriptures are translated into Greek, you actually have, and so maybe we'll just burst a little myth here. We talk about the Septuagint, right? So the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Well, in a sense, you didn't have the Septuagint. You had a variety of Septuagint versions, right? And so they come to Ecclesiastes, and this might be more technical than you wanted, but I love talking about this stuff. they come to Havel, and And so one version of the Septuagint, it's the predominant version, they translate the word in a way that could be translated emptiness, all right? Now, by the way, there are other ways to translate that word, but that seems sort of like a natural way. You have three other versions of the Septuagint that all translated havel with the Greek word atmos, which is the same word that's used in James 4:14. Do you not know that your life is a vapor? So what that demonstrates is that you had rabbis, in all likelihood, that were working on these Greek translations, and the at least the majority opinion during that time would have been that havel should be atmos or breath. Well, you have one translation, the one version of the Septuagint that rises to prominence, and it unfortunately is the one that translates it as empty. So Jerome then gets to his translation in the Latin Vulgate. And of course, Jerome is a monk. He's committed to asceticism, right? He has a view on the world that basically the world is evil, right? And so there's one Old Testament scholar, Ian Provon, actually makes quite a case that that Ecclesiastes ends up serving Jerome's purpose for the ascetic life the minute you go, everything's vanitas, right?
Right, yeah.
And so that was self-serving. I don't mean he did it maliciously. I'm just saying that for him, his mindset, vanitas is great. And I think that when we go back and we use the original Hebrew word, and we in a sense sort of get the barnacles of translational tradition off, we end up seeing that that breath or vapor is a far better translation. And I would just point out one thing. We could talk about this for a long time, but I would just point out one thing, and that is, when you read your Bible as a whole, do you get the message that life is meaningless or that life is a vapor? And the answer is, you go through the Psalms or the book of Job, and life goes by really fast. You know, Job gives the picture of my life is like the weaver's shuttle, right? Just and then it's gone. And so I think it's more consistent with the overall message of the Bible, and I think that it's more consistent with the meaning of the word.
Yeah, really good. Thank you. As Christians that believe in a sovereign God, we know and understand that everything happens for a reason. And this is often even said by non-Christians. Where does that inner awareness come from, and how does it help us reflect on hard things that happen that we don't understand as creatures?
Yeah, what a great question. So, you know, Ecclesiastes 3 ends up being just one of those famous, it might be the most famous passage in Ecclesiastes, where you have that there is an appointed time for every event under heaven, right? There's a season, there's an appointed season for everything. And then, of course, what happens is Solomon says, to begin with, a time to be born, a time to die. So the time to be born is appointed. The time to die is appointed. And then all the couplets that follow through, meaning everything else in life that happens in between those two points, has an appointed reason. We understand that as image bearers, right? This is why I think unbelievers can say it, is because even though the image is obviously marred, an image bearer still has, Ecclesiastes 3:11, eternity in their hearts. So you have this inherent sense of eternity. You have an inherent sense that things happen for a reason, right? And we actually can't shake that. That's something that that we inherently or intrinsically know. But then Solomon recognizes that, but then here's the key, is that he tells us, even though God's wired us to know there's a reason, and he's put eternity in our hearts so that we know, what is God doing? God's making all things beautiful in its time, right? So there's a plan. We know that inherently as image bearers. But then Solomon tells us, but God's not given us the ability to see the why.
Yeah. Okay?
And so the response for us with so as believers, with our understanding, God's sovereign over every detail of life. Okay. I have to recognize that this side of heaven, I'm not going to be able to see all the pieces of the puzzle. If I see two or three, that would be amazing. There are times that I may not see any, but yeah. it is therefore a call not to unravel the mystery. It's a call to trust the one who's sovereign yeah, right. over the mystery, right? And so to me, again, that is profoundly helpful. You know, in 2016, I ended up having a massive brain tumor, and that, you know, and I'm not, this is not a boast. I'm just saying from the very beginning, I had no question. God's sovereign over this tumor. This tumor is not an accident. This fits into God's plan. Did I know what that was? The answer is no. But could I trust him in the midst of knowing that he's sovereign, but not understanding what he's doing? Well, Ecclesiastes 3 was profoundly helpful for me.
Yeah, so good. Really helpful. Thank you. By reading Ecclesiastes, what do we learn about the oppression and the injustices that we see play out in the world we live in today?
Yeah, so, you know, you get into the end of chapter 3, you get into chapter 4, end of chapter 5 and into chapter 6, and you see all of these cases of injustice and oppression. And what Solomon does for us is, I think he does two things. One is he deals with those things realistically, all right? Just because life is a gift doesn't mean that there aren't really hard and inexplicable things that happen. In fact, the way that I would frame it would be that Solomon deals with oppression and injustice because those are things that in a sense threaten at least our idea of life as a gift, but also threatens the idea that God's really making all things beautiful in its time, right? So after having labored in chapters 1, 2, and the first part of chapter 3 to teach us life is a gift, God's making all things beautiful, Solomon then gives us a series of things that really seem to threaten those statements, you know. And I think that that Ecclesiastes gives us a perspective that tells us that this world's profoundly broken. Okay. Yes, it's profoundly rebellious. And the people who, for instance, oppress, or the people who are guilty of injustice, they are the in a sense, the quintessential portrait of a world that's in rebellion against God. But you also then have the oppressed, and you have those that are suffering the injustice. Sometimes it's self-inflicted. Like you get to chapter 6, a lot of the suffering and misery is self-inflicted. But certainly there are people that exploit the poor. There are people who oppress the weak and so forth. And Solomon deals with that realistically. And I think the way that he reminds us that in the end, everything's going to work out is there is a judgment that's coming. Okay. The oppressor and the one who is unjust, they don't escape. And then furthermore, the ones who have suffered under that, God does not forget their suffering.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's really powerful. You think of it in relationship to, for instance, the abortion issue, which, of course, in America, it just just rips our country apart. And you think of these little unborn babies that get that get dissected and vacuumed out of their mother's womb, and you go, there can be no more worse act, no more absolutely despicable act of oppression than taking advantage of the most helpless in our society. And, you know, so as Christians, I think we should do what we can to bring an end to that. But I'm also comforted to know that every single baby is not forgotten by God.
Yeah.
And that one of these days, God will bring justice to the earth.
Yeah. When you think about the brokenness of the world you've just been speaking about, it can be a trap for us to fall into by thinking, well, you know, dependent on who the new president's going to be or the new prime minister, they'll sort it all out. But this could be a little bit of a trap. What does Ecclesiastes teach us about this?
I love this part about it. This is in Ecclesiastes 5. And, you know, Solomon kind of paints this picture of you got this old king and, and he can't remember his name and he can't read the teleprompter or whatever, you know, and then some guy with this great success story comes and just takes the people by storm, and they love him, but they're going to get tired of him too, right? Yeah. Familiarity is going to breed contempt. And it really, in my estimation, what Solomon does, and Solomon knew about politics, all right? He really knew about politics. What it reminds us of is that, yes, there can be good rulers and bad rulers. We don't want to flatline that very clearly. But what it does is it reminds us that we can never actually put our hope in the next guy, and really for two reasons. One, it's a vapor anyway, right? It's a vapor. His term's going to be over in the blink of an eye. But the other thing is that people are so fickle, and leaders are. Their effectiveness in this fallen world can really only go so far. Mm-hmm. Nobody's actually going to come in and completely undo oppression and undo injustice and establish righteousness. There's only one that's going to do that, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right. And again, God is sovereign over all of our leaders as well, right?
Amen. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Brian, we live in such a materialistic world, don't we? And Solomon was reported to have owned and experienced anything and everything that money can buy. What lessons do we learn about money from him?
Well, let's start a little broader with Solomon's attempt in chapter 2, which is, you know, what you're referring to, where he goes on basically an accumulation and achievement rampage, you know. He's going to build the best. He's going to rebuild the Garden of Eden. He's going to build things better and bigger than anybody ever before. He's going to create the seven wonders of the world. He's going to have his name on every street sign. And he's also going to use drink and, in all likelihood, the physical pleasure. And the question is, what is he doing this for? Well, you know, if we read the whole of chapter 2, what we find out is that Solomon, in a sense, is trying to mitigate that sense that life is a vapor, right? Is there anything that can actually get me past this angst over that life is a vapor? And what he finds out is that all of the stuff that he accumulates, all of the stuff that he does, all the pleasure he tries to experience, I would put it this way. He realized that you can't vaporize Havel with Havel, right? Or you can't vaporize a vapor with a vapor.
Right.
And and so that's why he says, I turn around and I hated life. I realized all these achievements that I had, all the money that I made, all of the assets that I accumulated, I'm going to leave them to somebody else. I don't know what they're going to do with them. You know, I could leave them to, you know, to Junior, who's going to just absolutely have no appreciation and waste them away. I don't know what's going to happen. And so Solomon talks about money in Ecclesiastes at a number of points. And I want to say two things that we really take away from Solomon's teaching on money. And you see it in different ways. The miser who ends up eating in the dark by himself. And, you know, some of these dark pictures. One thing is that money will never give you a sense of substance in this vaporous life. Money can't do it. Money simply is not what's going to give you a sense of weightiness, right? So when I think of Ecclesiastes, right? So God's glory is weightiness, right? The kavod, the weightiness of God, and then you have vapor, so just weightlessness, right? And so when you think about money, money doesn't add any weight to life. It doesn't give us a sense of, ah, I finally arrived, or right, because, you know, the famous statement by I think it was Dale Carnegie or one of those super rich guys in the 1900s, you know, how much is enough? Just a little bit more. Solomon says that's the problem with money, is that you're never going to be satisfied with it. But he also says, and this is my paraphrase, if you have to choose between having no money and having money, you're going to choose to have money, because money actually does serve a purpose, right? Yeah. And so I think Solomon gives us a very, very balanced perspective that money does not solve your problems. If you live for it, it will destroy you. But actually having some kind of helps in this life, you know.
Yeah. As with all things, there are ditches on either side, aren't there, when taken to the extreme. When we think about our life here on Earth, we have on one hand voices urging believers to live their best life now, almost in disregard to eternity. And then on the other hand, we have these voices encouraging us to put our heads down and to look for nothing in this life and mournfully long for heaven. What are your thoughts on this, Brian?
Well, I think that that's exactly true, as you have these two extremes. And I think that Solomon would have scoffed at both extremes. In fact, one of the chapter titles is Your Better Life Now, right? And not your best life, okay? The Christian cannot have his best life now. Our best life will come when we're face to face with the Lord and in his presence. But you can live a life of fearing the Lord, walking in wisdom, doing good, enjoying life as a gift, and that makes life better. I tell our congregation from time to time, I'm like, if you want to slow down the sense of how fast life is going, just be a miserable person. Misery will slow things down for you, right? But if you're living a life of wisdom, a life of joy, a life of gratitude to God, it's going to go by pretty quick. And that's the better life, right? The better life than the miserable life. But on the other hand, the whole, you know, stick your head in the sand. There's nothing good in this world. Everything is evil. Everything is bad. What I think that does is I think that diminishes the goodness of God in this present life. God's given us all things to enjoy. That's what Paul tells Timothy. We're to receive those things with a sense of gratitude. And so a dear brother who really helped me a lot on the book and said some nice things about it, he said to me, and this was the perfect encapsulation. He said, after I read it, I wanted to go for a walk with my wife on the beach, play with my kids, and have a really good meal. And I think that those things, although a vapor, those things are God's kindness to us in this fleeting life. And and so enjoy them. Don't disdain them. Don't disdain them. But enjoy them.
Yeah, really helpful. Thank you. Brian, you managed to get Paul Washer to write the foreword to your book, and he was also very encouraging in what he said about it. How did this all come about?
Yeah, I wrote a book a few years ago called An Exile's Guide to Walking with God, and it's a devotional exposition of Psalm 119. And on a whim I thought, you know, I'll ask Paul Washer if he'll take a look. I'd done some projects with him in the past through Heart Cry, and so I sent it to him, and he was just incredibly kind. I mean, Paul Washer is truly a very, very humble servant of God. He wrote a really, really nice foreword to that little book, and so I thought, well, maybe he'll take a look at this. And I'm also thinking, so I want people that are going to read it with a critical eye, you know. So I sent it to an Old Testament scholar that I don't know, so he wouldn't feel an obligation to say something nice just because we might be friends. Right. And I thought, well, you know, Paul is such a sold out servant of God, right? I want him to look at it and give me his feedback. So shot him an email. He said, sure, send it to me. He says, I probably won't get to it for 2 weeks, which, I mean, is 2 weeks would have been really fast, frankly. And 2 days later, he got back to me with a phone call. And he was so encouraging. I couldn't believe it. I'm standing there and I'm looking at my wife and I'm like, Washer's on the phone, you know, and he was so encouraging. And then he called Jeff Johnson from Free Grace Press. And he was just really enthusiastic about the book. And wrote a really, really nice foreword, and I'm very, very grateful. And I'll have to say one more thing that he did. He went in that phone call. He asked, "Would you mind if I went through this go back over it with a fine tooth comb?" He sent me back the manuscript with, I would say, easily 150 suggestions. I mean, he went through it thoroughly. It was one of the best editing jobs I'd ever seen. And I will say that I took about 90 to 95% of those suggestions as pure gold.
Yeah. So. Wow. That's amazing. Well, that's so, so good. Brian, we're going to take, before we let you go, please take a moment to let us know your closing thoughts and also let people know how they can keep in touch with you.
Sure, sure. Well, if I could just give a closing thought on Ecclesiastes, really the burden of doing what I've done is to try to demonstrate that it's a positive book that gives us a very God-centered view of life, that enjoys the gifts of God in this short, vaporous life, and how to navigate through the stuff that doesn't make sense. And so if that helps anybody, I'll be really, really happy about it. Our church website, where you can access the sermons, is www.gracenevada.com. And then, of course, if you look on sermon audio, and then, of course, I'm on Facebook as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to find all of those links. I'm going to make sure they're in the description below wherever you're listening or watching to this interview, as well as a link to the book that we've been discussing today as well. Brian, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed speaking to you today.
Well, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.